5. I locked the door and pressed my back to it. And, with my mother's warning about the inescapable nature of the future still echoing in my ears, I scanned the interior of my room, for the first time feeling a sense of shame over how I'd chosen to decorate it. The posters on my walls, the books and comics and toys on my shelves, nearly all of them had once belonged to my late father. The room couldn't even be classified as a shrine to his memory because I didn't even remember the guy. This was more like a museum exhibit. A really sad, fucked up one, devoted to a man I'd never even known and never would. No wonder my mother avoided coming in here. Seeing the decor probably broke her heart 2 or 3 different ways. A small fleet of model spacecraft hung suspended from the ceiling on fishing line, and as I crossed my room, I brushed each of them with my fingertips, setting them in motion one after the other. First, the Starship Enterprise, then the Sulaco from Aliens, followed by an X-Wing, a Y-Wing, the Millennium Falcon, a Veritech fighter from Robotech, and, finally, a carefully painted Gunstar from The Last Starfighter. I pulled the window shades down, plunging the room into darkness save for a narrow shaft of moonlight that fell on my battered leather gaming chair in the corner, casting it in an otherworldly glow. As I collapsed into the chair, I sang the first 5 bars of Duel of the Fates to myself in anticipation. Dun dun da da da! I grabbed my dusty game console and disconnected my old plastic flight stick and throttle controllers, along with my bulky first-generation VR headset, which was held together with copious amounts of black electrical tape. Once the old gear was set aside, I connected the various components of my new interceptor flight control system and positioned them around my chair, placing the heavy metal flight stick on an old milk crate in front of me, directly between my knees, with the separate throttle controller on the flat armrest of my chair, within easy reach of my left hand. This setup was supposed to recreate the exact layout of the interceptor cockpit controls seen in the game, my own private starship simulator. Sitting there inside it, I remembered building a spaceship cockpit out of couch pillows in front of the television when I was a kid in an effort to make the experience of playing Star Fox on my Nintendo 64 more realistic. I'd had the idea after seeing some kids do it in an old Atari commercial for Cosmic Arc on one of my father's videotapes. Once I had my new controllers arranged properly, I synced my phone to the Bluetooth headphones built into my new Armada VR flight helmet. Then, I queued up my Raid the Arcade playlist, my digital recreation of an old analog mixtape I'd found among my father's things with that title carefully printed on its label in my father's handwriting. The title led me to assume that it was a compilation of his favorite gaming music, and I'd grown up listening to those songs while I played video games too. As a result, listening to my father's old Digital Combat compilation had become an essential part of my Armada gaming ritual. Trying to play without my Raid the Arcade playlist on in the background invariably threw off my aim and my rhythm. That's why I made sure I had it queued up before the start of every mission. I put on the faux interceptor pilot helmet and adjusted its built-in noise-canceling headphones, which completely covered each of my ears. After I adjusted the VR goggles to make sure they fit snugly over my eyes, I thumbed the small button that extended the helmet's retractable microphone. A completely pointless, yet undeniably cool feature. Then I retracted and extended the microphone a few more times, just to hear the sound it made. Once the game finished loading, I spent a few minutes customizing the button configuration on my new throttle and flight stick controllers, then logged onto the Armada multiplayer server. I immediately checked the EDA pilot rankings to make sure my ranking hadn't slipped since my last login, but my so cheesy it was cool call sign was still there in 6th place. I'd held that spot for over 2 months now, but a part of me was always still shocked to see it there, listed among the top 10, alongside the game's most famous and infamous players. I scanned the familiar collection of call signs, listed in what had now become a familiar order. 1. Red Jive. 2. Max Genius. 3. With Nailed. 4. Viper. 5. Rostam. 6. Iron Beagle. 7. Wody. 8. Crazy G. 9. Atomic Mom. 10. Cushmaster 5000. I had been seeing these 10 call signs almost every night for years, but I didn't actually know who any of those people really were or where they lived either. Aside from a few casual acquaintances at school and work, Cruz and Deal were the only Armada pilots I'd ever met in real life. The game had over 9 million active players in dozens of countries, so clawing my way up into the top 10 had been no easy feat. Even with what I've been told is a natural talent for video games, it had still taken me over 3 years of daily practice before I even managed to crack the top 100. Once I'd crossed that threshold, I finally seemed to find my groove, and in the months that followed, I made a meteoric rise into the top 10, while also rising up the ranks of the Earth Defense Alliance, earning one field promotion after another, until I was promoted all the way up to lieutenant. I knew Armada was only a video game, but I'd never been one of the best at anything before, and my accomplishment gave me a real sense of pride. Admittedly, all the time I'd had to devote to the game had shaved a full point off my grade average, and it had probably cost me my relationship with Ellen, too. But I'd already vowed to turn over a new leaf, I reminded myself. After tonight's mission, no more Armada for at least 2 full weeks, even if that meant sacrificing my position in the top 10. No great loss, I told myself. The higher you were ranked, the more trash talk, friendly fire, and accusations of cheating you had to endure from the other players. Case in point, the Armada pilots currently ranked in the top 5 were easily the most loathed players in the game's brief history. This was partly because the top 5 ranked pilots had the honor of painting their drones with their own customized multicolored designs, while the rest of us flew plain old stainless steel ones. That was how the top 5 had earned their nickname, the Flying Circus. A lot of posters in the Chaos Terrain forums seemed to believe the top 5 pilots were just too good to be real players, and that they had to be NPC bots or Chaos Terrain employees. Others theorized they were an elitist gamer clan because the 5 of them never responded to messages or in-game chat requests. Of course, that may have been because noobs were always accusing them of cheating by using some sort of client hack to auto-aim or give their shields infinite energy, but it was all bullshit sour grapes. I've been going head-to-head with Red Jive, a.k.a. the Red Baron, and the other members of the Flying Circus on the free-for-all deathmatch servers for over a year now, and I'd never once seen any sign they were cheating. They were just better than everyone else. In fact, studying their moves and learning from them was how I'd climbed into the top 10. I still found their general arrogance obnoxious, though, especially Red Jive, who had an infuriating habit of sending the same text message every time he shot someone else down in the game's player-versus-player practice mode. You're welcome. Those two words would flash on your screen, accompanied by a blood-boiling beep. Red Jive obviously had a macro set up to fire that message like a missile right after he blasted your ship to bits, literally adding insult to injury. I knew why he or she did it, too. It was a tactical move designed to anger his opponents and throw them even further off balance right before they respawned in another ship. And it worked, too, on everyone, including me. But one of these days, when I finally got Red Jive between my crosshairs, it would be my turn to send one of those infuriating texts. No, 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 Red Jive. You're welcome. Of course, now I got accused of hacking all the time, too. To quote my wizened boss, Ray Wierzbowski, "That's how you know you've mastered a video game, when a bunch of butthurt crybabies start to accuse you of cheating in an effort to cope with the beatdown they've just suffered at your hands." When I pulled up my friends list, I saw that Cruz and Deal were both already logged in, their player rankings listed beside their call signs. Cruz, whose call sign was Quoth, was currently in 6,791st place, and Deal, a.k.a. Delio, was ranked 7,445th. Their Terra Firma player rankings were much higher, but they were both still a long way from making it into the 30 dozen like Ray. I switched on my helmet microphone and joined Quoth and Delio on their private voice chat line. "You still won't admit you're wrong?" Cruz was shouting as I logged in. I told you, your Wonder Woman argument proves nothing, Deal said. Yes, Princess Diana of the Mascara did once wield Mjolnir in some obscure bullshit crossover issue. That only proves my point, Cruz. Do you think Wonder Woman would ever be caught dead wielding Sting? No, but she's a superhero and they don't use swords, do they? Cruz said, clearly without thinking his statement through. Superheroes don't use swords, Deal said gleefully. What about Nightcrawler? Deadpool, Elektra, Shatterstar, Green Arrow, Hawkeye. Oh, and then there's Blade and Katana, two superheroes who are actually named after swords. Oh, and Wolverine had that idiotic Muramasa blade made with part of his soul, which, while incredibly lame, is still a far cooler magical weapon than Sting. Sorry to interrupt, ladies, I said. I think you should just agree to disagree. Iron Seagull, Cruz called out. I didn't see you log in. You're late, fool, Deal said, and Cruz won't shut up about Wonder Woman. I'm right on time, I said. The briefing doesn't start for another 30 seconds. What the hell happened with you and Air Nocta today? Deal asked. He said it with a thick German accent. Nothing happened, I said, because I split before anything did. Well, he was making threats toward you to his idiot friends after the bell rang, he said. Vengeance is in his eyes and all that. Plan accordingly. I cleared my throat. Time is short. Let's talk mission, guys. If this is another disruptor takedown, I'm out, y'all, Cruz said. I'll bail and play Terra Firma instead. I'm serious, guys. What's the matter, Quoth? I asked. Don't you enjoy a challenge? I enjoy balanced gameplay, Cruz replied. I'm not a masochist like you. I felt a brief impulse to defend the game, but it was hard to argue the point. The Disruptor was a powerful new weapon the Sobrukai had unveiled after one of the game's most recent content updates. It was capable of disrupting the quantum communication link to all of Earth's defensive drones, rendering them useless. For the past few months, all of the game's most devoted players, myself included, have been trying to figure out how to disable the Disruptor's defenses and destroy the damn thing. But so far, the Sobrukai's new superweapon had proven to be indestructible, and that made many of the game's higher-level missions more or less unwinnable. Despite the endless barrage of complaints claiming that Chaos Terrain had broken and or ruined their own game, the company refused to remove the Disruptor from the enemy's arsenal or make it easier to destroy. As a result, a lot of Armada players were defecting to play Terra Firma. The Disruptor never showed up in any TF mission, maybe because by the time one made landfall, there was nothing the EDA's ground troops could do to stop it. It's a new mission, I said. Be optimistic. There might not be a Disruptor in it. Yeah, Deal said. Maybe the devs have cooked up something even worse. What could possibly be worse? Cruz asked. A mission where you have to blow up a Death Star while being attacked by two Borg cubes inside an asteroid field? Cruz, Deal immediately chimed in. I highly doubt that either the Borg or... Thankfully, an alert sounded in our headphones just then, signaling the start of the mission briefing. All of the data display windows vanished, and I found myself seated in a packed briefing room with Cruz's and Deal's uniformed avatars, Quoth and Delio, sitting on either side of me. We had each customized our avatars so that they vaguely resembled our real selves, only slightly taller, more muscular, and less pale. The avatars of a few other last-minute arrivals were materializing in the tiered seats around us. In the fictional near-future reality of Armada, Cruz, Deal, and I were drone pilots stationed at Moonbase Alpha, a top-secret military outpost on the moon's far side. They were both lowly corporals, while I held the coveted rank of lieutenant. The lights in the virtual briefing room dimmed, and the spinning crest of the Earth Defense Alliance appeared on the viewscreen in front of us. As the crest faded away, it was replaced by the familiar face of Admiral Archibald Vance, the Earth Defense Alliance's highest-ranking officer. The actor Chaos Terrain had hired to portray the Admiral totally nailed the part. His jagged facial scar and eye patch might have seemed over the top on another actor, but this guy somehow managed to sell the whole look and make you believe he really was a battle-hardened military commander facing impossible odds with weary determination and grim resolve.
Greetings, pilots,
the Admiral said, addressing us from the view screen. This evening's mission will not be an easy one, but it's one I know many of you have been hoping and waiting for since this war first began. Humanity has suffered countless unprovoked attacks from these alien invaders over the years, but now we're finally going to take this fight to them. The corners of the Admiral's mouth turned upward in the faintest hint of a smile, the closest I'd ever seen him come to displaying an emotion. Tonight, we're finally going to hit them where they live. Literally. The viewscreen window displaying the Admiral's face shrank and moved to the top right-hand corner, while the rest of the screen displayed a technical diagram of a ship model I'd never seen before. Its design reminded me a little bit of the Sulaco from Aliens. Its elongated, armored hull made it look like a heavy-caliber machine gun drifting through the void of space. This is the EDA's first interstellar drone carrier, the SS Doolittle. After traveling for over 2 years and nearly 7 times the speed of light, the Doolittle has finally reached its target. And your target for this mission, the enemy's home planet of Sobrakai. Finally! Cruz shouted over the comm, perfectly echoing my own reaction. All of the previous Armada missions had been focused on defense, and the game's action had always been confined to our own solar system, oftentimes on Earth itself, in the skies over a major city or military outpost the Sobrakai were attacking. Although we'd also locked horns with them out beyond the orbit of Mars, near the edge of the asteroid belt, and on the far side of the moon. This was the first mission that had ever involved an offensive against our enemy, and we'd hit the motherlode. As soon as the Doolittle reaches Sobrakai's orbit, the Admiral went on, it will deactivate its cloaking device before launching the Icebreaker, our weapon of last resort, along with an escort of fighters that will be under your control. The Admiral began to play the tactical previs on the screen. The computer animation showed the cloaked Doolittle swinging into orbit above Sobrakai, and the armada of glittering warships that encircled its equator like an artificial planetary ring. Spaced out evenly along this ring were 6 massive chrome orbs, Sobrakai dreadnought spheres. The players had nicknamed them motherships. This was the first time we'd ever had to go up against more than one of them. The bay doors embedded on the starboard side of the Doolittle's bow irised open, and the Icebreaker launched out of it, accompanied by a dense escort of 36 fighters. The Icebreaker looked like what it was, a giant focused beam laser bolted to an orbital nuclear weapons platform. The moment it began to fire its powerful melt laser down at the thick layer of ice covering the planet's surface, Sobrakai fighters began to pour out of the 6 dreadnought spheres, streaming forth from glowing, slit-like hangar doors that had opened in their armored skins to engage with the comparatively tiny group of EDA fighters protecting the Doomsday weapon being fired directly down at the icy roof of their squid crib. Eat it! Deal cried in mock triumph. How does it feel, assholes? You like that? I smiled under my helmet. Deal was right. After months of getting our asses handed to us on our home court, this chance to strike back at the Sobrakai on theirs was going to be hugely cathartic. Your mission is to keep the Icebreaker operational for approximately 3 minutes, just long enough for it to melt through the ice and launch its warheads into the planet's subsurface ocean, destroying the enemy's underwater lair, an aquatic hive located on the ocean floor. The tactical animation showed our drone fighters handily defending the Icebreaker from the enraged enemy armada just long enough for it to finish melting its giant hole and launch its warheads through it into the planet's subsurface ocean. At this point, the ICBMs transformed into guided nuclear torpedoes, which quickly homed in on the Sobrakai's underwater cave city, which looked like a high-tech hive built into the ocean's rocky floor. Now I feel bad, Deal said. Like we're about to nuke Aquaman, or the Little Mermaid? Pretend they're Gungans, Cruz said, and that we get to nuke Jar Jar. They both laughed, but I was still focused on the tactical animation. It showed the EDA's torpedo nukes closing in on the Sobrakai's aquatic hive like a volley of squid-seeking missiles. A few of them were knocked out by the hive's defense turrets, but the vast majority reached their target. The ensuing detonations lit up the view screen like an old-school game of Missile Command. Sobre Kai Central was obliterated, and the force of the subsequent thermonuclear explosions rocked the planet so violently that cracks spread across the entire circumference of its icy surface, making it resemble a shattered, hard-boiled egg. There were no mushroom clouds, only a massive column of red steam rising from the massive hole burned in the surface, which shot straight up into orbit as if the planet were spraying blood from a gunshot wound. "It's another suicide mission," Cruz said, "but it still looks fun. I'm in." It looked as if our inept alien enemy had made another colossal tactical mistake. They had not only let their faster-than-light propulsion technology fall into our reverse-engineering monkey hands, they had then given us enough time to build an interstellar warship of our own and send it all the way across the vast gulf of space to launch a counterattack against them. As usual, the alien invaders' tactics didn't make a whole lot of sense. And as usual, I didn't care. I just wanted to kill me some aliens, and this was the juiciest setup for a balls-out kamikaze mission in the history of the game. Maybe any game. In my headset, the Admiral's voice was drowned out by the sound of Deal pretending to snore. "Come on, old man!" he shouted. "Less talk, more rock!" "Yeah, I wish we could skip this storyline crap," Cruz said. "Boring!" "See? This is exactly why you two always get killed within the first 2 minutes," I said. "You never pay attention during the Admiral's briefing." "No, we always get killed because of you, Leroy Jenkins!" "I've asked you repeatedly to stop calling me that." "If the shoe fits, smack attack," Cruz said. "Why don't you try being a team player for once? Just once." "Interplanetary warfare isn't a team sport," I replied. "Never has been." "Actually, it kind of is, if you think about it," Deal chimed in. "The home team versus the visitors. Get it? Visitors?" After a pause, he added, "Because they're aliens?" "Yeah, we got it," I said. "Will everybody shut up so I can hear the rest of this?" "This mission must succeed," the Admiral was telling us now. "That armada is preparing to depart for Earth. So this is our one and only chance to destroy the Sobre Kai before they come here to destroy us. The fate of humanity depends on the icebreaker reaching its target." He paused to clasp his hands behind his back. "We're only going to get one shot at this, people, so let's make it count." "Are you kidding?" Cruz shouted, as if the pre-recorded actor could hear him. "This better not be a single-play mission. It's way too awesome!" "He was just saying that for dramatic effect," I said. "I'm sure we'll be able to replay it, just like with the disruptor scenarios." "You better be right," Deal said, "because there's no way in hell we're going to pull this mission off on our first try, or our second or third either. They've got 6 dreadnought spheres, each one loaded with over 1 billion killer alien drones, and a disruptor to boot." "They won't activate one of their disruptors here," Cruz pointed out. "It wouldn't have any effect. For a quantum link to be disrupted, both the transmitting and receiving ends have to be inside the sphere." That was the reason the EDA had drones and humans stationed on the far side of the moon. "With no disruptor to worry about, this should be doable," I said. "All we have to do is protect that icebreaker for 3 minutes. No problemo." "No problem," Cruz repeated. "Really? You think so?" "Yeah, we just, you know, create a blockade." "With what?" Cruz said. "Did you check the mission stats? Our carrier only brought 200 drones along. The Admiral failed to mention that." "Maybe he did it when you two were snoring," I suggested. "Like I said before, this is yet another example of unbalanced, poorly thought out gameplay," he continued. "The devs at Chaos Train are trying to piss us off now. We're going to get slaughtered again." "Yeah, yeah," Deal said. "How do I get out of this chicken shit outfit?" I laughed. Before Cruz could reply, we realized that Admiral Vance was bringing his chalk talk to a close. "Good luck, pilots. Everyone down here on Earth is counting on you." He snapped us a farewell salute, and his image winked out on the view screen, once again replaced by the Earth Defense Alliance crest. Then, while the mission loaded, we were all treated to a familiar cutscene showing our squadron of heroic-looking, slightly out-of-focus EDA pilots sprinting out the briefing room's exit, down a brightly lit access corridor, and on into the Moonbase Alpha Drone Operations Control Center, A large circular room with dozens of oval hatchways embedded in the floor, spaced only a few meters apart, each containing a drone controller pod. Their hatches hissed open, revealing simulated interceptor cockpits. Each one a pilot seat, surrounded by an array of controls and readouts, along with a wraparound view screen shaped like a cockpit canopy window. The cutscene ended, and my perspective shifted back to my avatar's POV. Only now, I was sitting inside my own drone controller pod. A second later, the hatch hissed closed above me, just as all of the control panels around me lit up, as did the wraparound view screen. This created a second layer of simulation, the illusion that I was now sitting inside an ADI-88 aerospace drone interceptor, powered up and waiting in its coiled launch rack in the Doolittle's drone hangar. I reached out to blindly place my hands on the new controllers in front of me, adjusting their placement to match the layout of my virtual cockpit inside the game. Then, I took a deep breath and exhaled it slowly, trying to relax. This was usually the best part of my day, when I got to escape my suburban existence for a few hours and become a crack fighter pilot duking it out with evil alien invaders. But tonight, I didn't feel like I was escaping anything. I felt anxious, excited, righteous, maybe even a little bloodthirsty. Like I was going to war.